You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, the Trump administration released a 1,600-page report last week that warned of severe economic and health outcomes if the U.S. doesn't address climate change. A Wisconsin expert on environmental politics joins us for a look at those new findings. First, a warning that in this next segment, we'll be talking about some topics that may not be suitable for younger listeners. The phrase hookup culture has grown in popularity in recent years. It's often used to describe the sexual practices of today's younger generation and what many think of as their preference for casual sex. But here's the real story. A growing body of research shows that young people today are having less sex than their counterparts in generations past. Kate Julian is a senior editor at The Atlantic. She looked at this recently in a piece headlined "The Sex Recession." Kate, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's start with the numbers. What do we know about trends in how much sex people are having?
So the research that you mentioned, which has been published in a series of articles in one of the leading sex research journals, finds a few things. First of all, the average adult has gone from having sex 62 times a year to 54 times a year between the late 90s and 2014, which might not seem like a lot for a given person. They might not even notice it. But when you look at it nationally, obviously something is going on. When we look at young people, specifically people now in their 20s, are more likely, 2.5 times more likely to be celibate than people in their 20s were in previous generations, so Gen Xers and boomers. They're launching their sex lives later, and they're on track to have fewer lifetime sexual partners.
And this is true at the teen level too, right? Teens are putting off sex later and later over the years.
Exactly. And that seems to be part of a decline in romantic relationships in adolescence, although there's less data on that point.
And this all may contradict what people think. When you look in pop culture that relates to young people, it seems like there's a lot of sex going on out there, a lot of hookups. Even there's a lot of feature reporting with this idea that hookup culture is all over the place. Why do we have this kind of contrast between what I think we think about what young people are doing and what they're actually doing?
You're right. It's completely counterintuitive, right, that in the age of hookup culture, so-called, and digital porn and dating apps, that people would perhaps be having less sex. But I think the sort of larger point here is that people have for a long time overestimated how much sex other people are having. And that's particularly likely to be the case when we talk about younger people. That being said, you know, we can see that the numbers just don't bear that out. So clearly something is going on here. And whatever it is that's going on, I look at several possible causes in the piece, it seems to really have taken place over the past 15 years or so.
And you list the different causes people have pointed to, and we'll get into some of the kind of main themes, but people have pointed toward a lot of different possibilities. Mm-hmm. There are a zillion theories out there about why younger people are having less sex.
Yeah, so at the top of the piece, I rattle off quite a long list of them. But there are sort of four or five really key things that I zero in on the piece. The first thing is that people under the age of 35 are quite a bit less likely to be living with a spouse or another partner than in past generations. Economics is a big part of that, obviously. So, too, maybe the fact that more people, as I mentioned earlier, are coming into adulthood with less romantic experience as teenagers. Second sort of big category is digital distraction. That may be making people more isolated as they seek out sort of solitary entertainments. Porn is one part of that, but not necessarily in the way that people expect. Specifically, it seems that learning about sex from porn may be having some downsides for some people. Third big category has to do with dating apps. They work for some people, but they've also changed the dating landscape pretty rapidly, and they clearly don't work very well for another very large group of people. They can be demoralizing and pretty inefficient. Finally, depression, anxiety, poor self-image, all of which seem to be on the rise among young people, tend not to be great for one's ability to go out and date, and they also tend to be libido killers.
Talking to Kate Julian, senior editor at The Atlantic, about her piece on declining amounts of sex for younger Americans, the causes and consequences. We'll dig more into maybe the causes, Kate, but let's talk about the outcomes here. People might look at that, at those teen numbers in particular, say, great, don't mind teens putting off sex till later, teen pregnancy numbers down, lovely, but people are worried about some consequences here.
Exactly. Well, there are. I do want to pause and say that some of the aspects of this are, as you say, positive. The teen pregnancy rate is a third of its modern high in the early 90s. That's absolutely terrific news. It's also terrific that more people are saying that their first sexual encounter, when it does happen, is something they really wanted, something they welcome. That's also terrific news. The problem comes when you start to talk to people in their 20s, as I did for this story, and you find that many people are having trouble connecting with other people. And it's not that they're choosing other things instead of sex or relationships, or that they're putting off sex and relationships voluntarily on their own timeline, but actually that they're struggling in those departments.
Right. The decline in sex may be a symptom of a decline in relationship building.
Exactly. The concerning thing to me here is not necessarily sex per se, although we can talk more about sex sort of as an indicator of health and well-being and also as a contributor to health and well-being. But what this may say about our capacity for intimacy, whether intimacy of all sorts, not just physical but also emotional, is becoming more elusive to some people for some combination of reasons at this point in time.
Yeah, a big, and you were touching on this earlier with that list of possible theories, our devices, the internet connections. We have a lot of solitary pursuits that can eat up our time that we don't need to negotiate with another person on. We don't need to arrange with another person. We go solo and in a number of different ways that we can get into. Talk about that a little.
Yeah, people tend to jump to porn on this one, and we can talk about that a bit. But I think the internet in general is a big factor. It's such a predictable answer that I hate to go right there, but it does seem to be a big part of this story. One fascinating study looked at the arrival of broadband internet access in the late 90s in counties across the country and was able to correlate that with the declining teen pregnancy rate and found that the arrival of broadband internet was responsible for up to 14% of the teen pregnancy rate decline. And that's just a fascinating statistic. I think also the rise of sort of streaming entertainment generally, and this isn't just a factor for teens, this may also be sort of at one of the root causes of some of what we're seeing with the decline in sexual frequency among adults of all ages. The peak time of internet usage is in the evening, time that we would normally be spending with our spouse and partner. There is literally always something that you want to watch available on TV now.
And another related note is that it seems like while sex with other people has gone down, masturbation, if I'm seeing the numbers right, has gone up.
That's right. So between 1992, when one of the first big nationally representative sex studies was done, in 2014, the percent of American men who reported masturbating in the past week, or in a given week rather, doubled to 54%, and their share of women more than tripled to 26%. That's obviously, you know, a big change in a relatively short period of time. Whether or not that's, you know, substituting for sex, slightly harder question to answer, but clearly, you know, it's a big change in behavior. Porn is part of that, but it's not the only factor. One recent study found that half of American women report having used a vibrator. That's presumably a big increase from the past when you couldn't buy things like that at a drugstore or on the internet.
You talked to, as you mentioned, a number of people in their 20s. Did they talk about porn and masturbation as something that replaced sex with another person, or was it a whole different universe in their minds?
It's interesting. It was, to some extent, a different universe, which is to say it wasn't totally unrelated to wanting to stay home and not going out and meeting people and doing things with people in person, but it was related to those things in the same way that some of the other things I've mentioned were. So social media, sort of messing around on the internet, streaming television. It was just one more digital distraction. Many people I spoke to, in fact, were really clear to say this: my porn life is one thing, my sex life or lack thereof is another. They aren't, you know, one isn't a straight trade-off for the other. And yet, clearly, they are related to some extent. If these things are sort of taking the edge off of people's desire, as one sex therapist put it to me, it could be making people less likely to go out and, you know, look for a partner in the real world.
We're talking to Kate Julian with The Atlantic about what she says is a growing body of research showing people are having less sex. She talked to researchers who had made those findings and people in their 20s in particular. This is the younger generation now having less sex than younger generations 20, 40 years ago. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this surprising to you? If you're a young person yourself and you feel comfortable talking about it, is this something that resonates with you? Is this what you see with your friends in your own life? And for anyone, do you have a question for a guest about what she found? Does this trend worry you? Do you think it's a good thing? What's driving it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation now about why young people are having less sex than their predecessors and previous generations, what it means for relationships and for happiness. Kate Julian is with us. She's a senior editor at The Atlantic. Her recent piece on this is titled The Sex Recession. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you notice a difference in the way members of younger generations think about the importance of relationships and of sex? What do you think factors into this change in sexuality over the years? If you're the parent of a young adult or a teen, does this trend look like good news for you? If you're a millennial, what do you see going on? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. To your calls now, John is with us in Mount Horeb. John, hi.
Hey there. Really interesting topic, and I've talked a lot with I have some cousins that are the same age. I'm 30, and just recently had a baby boy, and we talked to a bunch of friends that don't have kids, and they're always just so worried about the adding to the already overpopulated world. You know, they're like, oh no, I don't want to add another person to this already overpopulated world. I want to adopt things, which is great, but I think that might be there's some sort of a trauma or some sort of a feeling of worry that I don't think a lot of other generations before us had when it comes to, you know, sex and bringing a child into this world. I think that might be why people are a little more, you know, less likely to have, you know, sexual relations that may.
John, thanks a lot for calling in. Is that something you heard, Kate, from people you talked to or researchers?
Absolutely. So part of the context for all of this is that sort of some of these reports of declining sex rates have prompted worry from people who note that the fertility rate in the U.S. has been dropping. It recently hit a historic low for a second year running, having as recently as 10 years ago been at sort of above two children per women. It's now closer to 1.7 children per woman. And that's a change. And so part of the question is, are millennial women delaying having families, or are they just going to be less likely to have as many children as previous generations did? When I talked to people about their sort of hopes and dreams, I heard from a lot of people who really wanted to have children and were concerned that they might not be able to find a partner with whom to do that. But I also did hear from a lot of people who had some real concerns about whether that was a responsible choice for them, either given sort of worries about their own life and its precarity for financial or other reasons, or as the caller alluded to, sort of concerns about the planet and climate change and other sort of aspects of an uncertain future.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go now to Craig with us in Madison. Hi, Craig.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to tell us about?
I wanted to say, as a parent of a couple teenagers, one thing that I definitely noticed was that they're less interested in having a boyfriend or a girlfriend now, and definitely more interested in consuming media, you know, whether it's social media or consuming Netflix and stuff like that. And I also noticed, just in general, they tend to not hang out with friends as much, and I noticed that throughout actually their entire friend group.
Craig, thanks a lot for sharing that. And that is part of the story, right, Kate?
It absolutely is. Now, the researcher whose work provided a springboard for this article, Jean Twenge, who's a psychologist at San Diego State University, recently published a book called iGen, which looked at the sort of cohort of people now in their late teens and early 20s, and found that on a number of markers, adolescence has really sort of come to look quite different than it did maybe 20 years ago. And this doesn't just regard sex or dating. It also involves things like getting your driver's license, working for pay outside the home, going out with friends without your parents. All of these activities have become quite a bit less likely than they once were. And that does seem to coincide with the rise of digital entertainment, like the caller said.
Craig, thanks a lot for calling in at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Kate Julian from The Atlantic about her piece on a decline in the amount of sex that young people are having today compared to previous generations. Back to your calls now. Derek is with us in Green Bay. Derek, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Derek?
Yeah, so I'm a teacher in northeastern Wisconsin. I grew up in northeastern Wisconsin, and I remember in the mid to early 2000s, going through school, we often had guest speakers that would come into our school and speak to us about celibacy, and there was an increased push for sex education in our schools. I'm just wondering if there was any link that was found in the research to a decline in sexual activity in our younger generation.
All right, sex ed, abstinence education, and whether or not kids are having sex, Kate.
This is such an interesting question. So when the teen pregnancy rate started to decline in the 90s, nobody could really agree on what was causing it. So backers of contraception and contraceptive education said it's contraception, but teenagers weren't using contraception enough more than in the past to account for the change. Backers of abstinence education, which got a big boost from the 1996 welfare reform bill, said it's abstinence education, but we've seen from studies that have come out in the decades since that abstinence education doesn't actually seem to promote abstinence. So then the question becomes, well, what might be the effect of sex education generally? And it's really hard to come up with a single answer to that because sex education in this country is really a patchwork. It varies wildly from state to state and from district to district, school district to school district, that is. We can say, just based on sort of interviews done by researchers and some of the interviews that I did myself, that some people seem to have had sex education experiences that they feel scared them off of sex. Sometimes people talked about sort of abstinence-only messages that made them feel that if they were to have a sexual experience, it would sort of make them undesirable to a future partner or spouse. Some people talked about seeing sort of photos of sexually transmitted diseases that really scared them. But another theme that came up that I thought was really interesting is that most millennials, or most members of Gen Z, I should say that they want comprehensive sex education. That is sex education that's not only abstinence-based. And they say that they didn't receive as much sex education as they would have liked, and they would have benefited from having more.
Derek, thanks for bringing that up. Rachel is with us now in Racine. Rachel, hello.
Hi.
What story do you have for us, Rachel?
Well, I have two daughters, 18 and 15, and we've always had a house where we talk openly about everything, and they share everything, whether I like it or not. And when my oldest approached me about wanting to have sex with her boyfriend, the three of us sat down and talked about it. And, you know, a couple years had went by, and my oldest one talked to my younger one about it and told her, you know, you should wait. It's worth waiting because, you know, we don't want to grow up too fast. So, I mean, for me, I was the mom that everybody came to ask the question. Huh. And most of their friends are kind of holding off too.
Rachel, thank you so much for sharing that. So teens, in this case anyway, Kate, making a very conscious case for waiting.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely a best case scenario. I mean, I think that one positive part of this may be that many adolescents have closer and more confiding relationships with their parents and can have the kind of conversation that the caller discussed, which can be really helpful. What can be more difficult is when young teenagers are learning about sex from porn in the absence of conversations with their parents or with educators. That can be really disorienting and can really, I think, lead to some behaviors that may not go over well with a real-life partner in young adulthood, and can also be scary and disorienting to people who don't really know what they're seeing and whether it's something that they would expect to experience in real life.
Thanks a lot for that call. Kate, in our last couple of minutes, I want to tackle a big issue, just in brief, that you write about: dating, relationships, finding a partner, massively changing from just 10, 15 years ago in the age of using an app instead of this crazy idea of going out with someone you know in person.
Exactly. I mean, the speed of this transition is really quite amazing. You know, 10 years ago, we didn't really have dating apps, and now they've become, by some counts, the leading way that people meet partners. And yet, it's clear, you know, that while they work very well for some people, people who meet that way, for example, in adulthood are more likely to get married more quickly than people who meet other ways. For other people, they don't work very well at all. They can be, as I said at the top, really time-intensive and kind of demoralizing. One of the things that was most surprising to me in the reporting of this piece was the extent to which people I interviewed said that they felt that the existence of apps had really changed the landscape in terms of how you could meet people in person and whether it was acceptable to strike up conversations. One man I talked to who had sort of been in a long-term relationship that started in 2007 and came out of that relationship in 2014 said that sort of, you know, when he came out of it, he found that trying to sort of strike up a conversation with a woman in real life in a bar seemed much more awkward and sort of socially unacceptable than it had been when he went into the relationship. Now, how much of that has to do with apps and how much of that has to do with the fact that when we're in public spaces, we're more likely to be on our phones now is an open question, but it was a really striking change.
We'll leave it there for now. Kate, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've been talking to Kate Julian, senior editor with The Atlantic. She was with us to talk about her latest piece looking into why young people are having less sex than previous generations, what that means for the future of happiness and relationships. There's a whole lot more to that story. You can find Kate's article at The Atlantic under the headline, The Sex Recession. And she also mentioned the researcher Jean Twenge. If you search the WPR.org archives, you can find my interview with her. It's been a year or so, I don't remember, but we talked to her about the book that Kate was talking about earlier. Coming up, a new federal report released last week paints a bleak picture of the future of the United States if the government doesn't tackle climate change. We'll learn more and what the report has to say about us here in the Midwest coming up after the news. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow after 8:30 on The Morning Show, find out how schools get state money for special education funding and some of the unique challenges facing districts in rural parts of the state. That's tomorrow at 8:30 on The Morning Show. Now, the Trump administration released the second part of its massive climate change report, this time looking at the impact climate change will have on the health of Americans and the effect it'll have on the U.S. economy. The outlook is grim, especially if carbon emissions don't go down. According to the report, if the government doesn't take action, the economy could shrink by nearly 10% by the end of the century, and we could see thousands of Americans die annually from climate-related issues, things like heat waves or outbreaks of diseases like West Nile virus. Despite 13 agencies backing the report, the president said yesterday he doesn't believe the published data. Moreover, the report's release on Black Friday has some speculating that the White House tried to bury the story on a slow news cycle. Our next guest joins us now to talk about the report, the response from the White House, and what steps the government can take to slow down climate change. Michael Kraft is Professor Emeritus of Political Science and Public and Environmental Affairs at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay. Michael, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, we've seen a lot of different reports, international and national, over the years. What's your reaction to this one? What's the significance?
Well, in many ways, the report confirms what previous studies and reports have indicated, which is climate change is real. It's important. It will have very significant effects on people's lives, on their employment, on the economy, and as you noted, on health. I think what's different about this one is this one deals with the U.S. itself. This is a federally mandated report. Congress mandated this in a 1990 law. So although the Trump administration released it, it's not a Trump administration document. It comes from 13 federal agencies, some 300 scientists. And it's basically like the other reports, a kind of state of the art, what we know today about the impacts of climate change, but also what we can do to help minimize those impacts.
And part of the story here isn't just what will the effects of climate change be, but what are the impacts of climate change right now, right?
Right. You know, many of these reports in the past have indicated where the impacts would be 30 or 50 or 100 years in the future, which, of course, provides little incentive for people to pay attention. This one, much like your news item, indicated wildfires in California linked to drought and climate change, warming, have cost billions of dollars in damage, and so have recent hurricanes in the south and southeast. So this is linking those, at least in part, to climate change, tells us there already are impacts. These impacts will likely be much greater in the future. But also there are some very specific things we can do now to reduce our reliance on fossil fuels and to try to minimize some of those impacts. And that, I think, is the real heart of this report. It documents in great detail in 1,600 pages, region by region across the country. So there's a section on the Midwest that includes Wisconsin, what these impacts are, also how we can adapt to them, the smart things to do to minimize the impacts, and above all, how we need to reduce our emission of greenhouse gases that is what's driving this whole process.
Well, let's start with that before we dig too much into the impacts. Let's talk about those opportunities you're talking about. What kind of things does the report lay out, especially here in the Midwest?
Well, in terms of reducing greenhouse gases, the whatever report emphasizes is the need to move away more or less quickly from the reliance on fossil fuels. Now, the Midwest, the report notes, is much more heavily reliant on coal than other parts of the country, about 56%. In Wisconsin, the figure is about 52%. The country has actually made great strides in moving toward renewable energy in recent years, particularly in terms of electricity generation. And the Obama administration made a number of decisions that would have put us on a better path for the future. A lot of those have been challenged by the Trump administration. The courts ultimately will rule on those. This is the so-called Clean Power Plan, which involves phasing out of coal-fired power plants and, of course, auto fuel efficiency standards. My guess is the Trump administration will not be very successful in court. And this new report actually strengthens the case of those in favor of action on climate change because it makes it hard to develop rules that overturn the Obama administration efforts, because now we have yet another scientific document on the reality of those impacts, and that is surely going to be part of the lawsuits pending against the Trump administration actions.
Talking to Michael Kraft, Professor Emeritus of Political Science and Public and Environmental Affairs at UW-Green Bay, looking at this big federal report on the impacts of climate change in the United States and opportunities to mitigate those impacts. I want to give a listen to President Trump. This is him yesterday asked if he had read the report. Here's part of what he had to say.
I've seen it. I've read some of it, and it's fine.
Did they say economic impact is devastating?
Yeah, I don't believe it.
You don't believe it?
No, I don't believe it. And here's the other thing. You're going to have China and Japan and all of Asia and all of these other countries, you know, addresses our country. Right now, we're at the cleanest we've ever been, and that's very important to me. But if we're clean, but every other place on Earth is dirty, that's not so good. So I want clean air. I want clean water. Very important.
So what do you make of the president's response there to this report?
Well, he was actually right about one thing, which is that the United States has become slightly cleaner in terms of greenhouse emissions in recent years, but most of that is due to the Obama administration efforts. The real questions about that, well, that will be true going forward. The other statement he made has an element of truth, but is a bit misleading, and that is he implied that the United States is the only country that's moving towards a clean path. And actually, the United States has been the world's leading laggard on climate change for many years. We reversed that just before the Trump administration, but I think, as most listeners know, Trump announced the U.S. would withdraw from the Paris Accord on climate change. And because of that lack of U.S. leadership, other countries may do less. But he's also correct that most countries are not living up to the commitments they made at Paris. My hope was that if the United States provided leadership and stuck to what it had committed itself to, other countries also would have done it. But if the United States withdraws and we increase reliance on fossil fuels, which this administration is trying to do, then it wouldn't be a surprise that other countries will say, then why should we go ahead at some short-term cost to do this if the United States will not act?
want to bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Mark is with us in New Berlin. Mark, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Say, I guess I'm pretty much agreeing with the last caller, but I throw in one thing more. If the United States and Western Europe stop producing CO2 today, zero, nothing, CO2 levels would continue to be higher than they were in the 1990s and would continue to increase because China and India are putting so much into the atmosphere. We are not the lagger in this, like your guest said. China and India have pumped so much carbon dioxide into, they're both the world's leaders in producing it, and I don't see what we can do short of removing the CO2 from the atmosphere with cooling plants or with organic plants.
Mark, thanks a lot for the call. A couple different points there. Michael, first of all, he's worried even if we act now, it's not going to make any difference.
Well, a lot of people have that sense of futility that it would be too little and too late, and countries like China and India are rapidly industrializing. But those countries are beginning to make a change, and my hope was that, and still is, that the United States would provide some reason for China to move even more quickly away from coal and towards cleaner sources of energy. China is emerging as the leader worldwide in the production of electric vehicles and is much more committed to that than the U.S. is. India is a little more problematic, but nobody said it would be easy going forward. I think the U.S. has a role to play, and it's certainly also true, as the caller noted, that despite our cutting back on greenhouse gas emissions, both here and around the world, the reality is greenhouse gases stay in the atmosphere for a long time. So that measured greenhouse gases in the atmosphere continue to rise. So all of the effects that the new report underscored, both for the Midwest and for the rest of the country, you know, are still likely to be highly problematic going forward.
And Mark also mentioned the hopes of maybe pulling CO2, carbon dioxide, out of the atmosphere. Is that something that is legitimately on the horizon?
Not on the near-term horizon. That would be, ideally, we would compensate in part for our emission of greenhouse gases by removing carbon, much as trees and other vegetation already do that. But on an industrial scale, we don't yet have a technology at a sufficient cost level to be able to do that. Putting more money into research on developing those technologies makes a lot of sense, as it does developing new sources of energy, particularly electricity generation going forward. So there's much the government can do, there's much that the private sector can do, and much that individuals can do simply with energy conservation and efficiency that would help delay the onset of some of these impacts the report talks about.
We're talking to Michael Kraft. He's a professor emeritus of political science and public and environmental affairs at UW-Green Bay. He's with us to talk about the climate change report released on Friday. That report shows that thousands of Americans could die and the U.S. economy could shrink if the government doesn't take action to alleviate climate change. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the report and what you've seen about it? What kind of actions would you like to see taken to slow climate change, whether by the federal, state, local governments, individuals, businesses? What concerns do you have about climate change and global warming? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation about the climate change report released by the federal government on Friday. Michael Kraft is with us, professor emeritus of political science and public and environmental affairs at UW-Green Bay. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about this report? What kind of action, if any, do you want to see taken when it comes to climate change by the federal government, by other agencies as well? Call in at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Ned is with us in Lake DeBay. Ned, what do you think?
Yes, two quick things. As a professor emeritus in the UW system, we always try to encourage our students to use critical thinking. And using critical thinking, we need to look at the credentials of the scientists that did the National Climate Assessment. These people have devoted decades of their lives to their profession. They know what they're talking about. There's 13 federal agencies and at least 300 scientists involved. And for President Trump to dismiss them is unconscionable without being specific. You've got to be specific if you're going to say this is not something that he believes in. Well, why not? Then the second thing is, we know what to do to address climate change. It's not like we are searching for some way to do it. We know what to do, and we need to have the political will to do it. And one of the things we can do, it's not the only thing, but one thing we could do is being done by Canada right now, carbon fee and dividend, increase the price of fossil fuels until they are more expensive than renewable energy. And then people in a free market society will choose the less expensive renewable energy, and we will make the transition over to renewable energy. And the dividend part of it is to offset the additional cost of the fossil fuel. So the president, so the federal government would collect money for more expensive fossil fuels and then return it to the consumers of our country in the form of a dividend, so that they would break even in most cases. Or in
Gotcha, Ned. I'll jump in, Michael. Something like a carbon tax, in effect, I think, is what he's describing.
Right, and specifically, the Citizens Climate Lobby has proposed a what we call a revenue-neutral carbon tax, so carbon fees and dividend, meaning all the extra taxes are returned to individuals, so there's no net increase in taxes. But what you do is price fossil fuels and fossil fuel-related products at a higher level and let the free market have some effect. So I can't disagree with very much that Ned said. Clearly, in rejecting the report and saying he read some of it, which is, I think, a little bit doubtful given the president's habits, but he pretty clearly just rejected it out of hand. He doesn't believe it. He doesn't believe scientists in general on this subject and on other subjects. And as Ned pointed out, these are federal agency scientists who have spent their entire careers working on this subject, and they deserve the kind of attention that the press and the country is giving to this report, even if the White House chooses not to do so.
Ned, thanks for the call. Going out to John in Madison. John, hi.
Hi. I know the report addressed the damage that would happen to the U.S. and our economy as a result of climate change. I wonder if there's any emphasis on the positive side. If we address climate change, how many jobs could be produced from a changing economy, from new technologies that could be used to address climate change? I'm wondering, and if it's not addressed in this report, is there evidence out there about jobs that would be produced from changing technologies and attempting to address climate change? Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. There is evidence. This report, as far as I can tell, I didn't read all 1,600 pages, read the entire section on the Midwest and other sections. I don't believe it deals directly with employment opportunities in climate change mitigation and adaptation, but clearly there will be, and other studies have underscored that we can have solid economic growth, job creation, while still promoting the kind of transition that the caller and other callers have referred to, which is a transition to renewable energy. The report does try to document the impacts, particularly on agriculture and farmers in the Midwest, and as you noted, on public health because of increased air pollution and the like. But all the actions that we can take also carry some economic benefits. And if we're smarter about the way we plan infrastructure, if we can reduce the risk of flooding and the damage that comes from flooding, that's all an economic gain as well.
Thanks a lot for that call. I want to drill back into the report a little, Michael. Down to the local level, in the Midwest section, they talk about how local governments could take steps to prevent carbon emissions and also build climate change resilience. And they say only, I think, four local agencies or local governments have an agency to deal with that.
Yes, I saw that part. It was rather striking that only four local governments would do that, because in a way this is part of what we sometimes call community sustainability efforts, and many more cities have sustainability offices. One would have thought they would pay more attention to things like where you put roads and at what level, and stormwater management and assistance to farmers to make sure that the crops they're planting and where they're planting them will be resistant to the kind of temperature increases and rainfalls that we expect. Madison and other parts of Wisconsin actually had an experience with this back in August, when we had historic levels of torrential rainfall and with extensive flooding. So there are things that cities can do about that if they have the well power and have a plan in place, which is you plan for better stormwater management, you make sure roads are not subject to flooding, you upgrade facilities, infrastructure as needed. And doing so, of course, is a positive for the economy while preventing future damage.
We are talking to Michael Kraft, Professor Emeritus of Political Science and Public and Environmental Affairs at UW-Green Bay, looking at a new federal climate change report, a big report that came out on Black Friday, looking at the possible economic impacts, health impacts, and more in the Midwest and around the United States if climate change isn't dealt with. Back to your calls now. Jay is with us in Washburn. Jay, hi.
Hi. I'm going to take it back out to the global level and ask, when we compare other countries with the United States, such as China and India, how do we compare on a per capita basis with total output of carbon dioxide? And I'll take your response off the air.
Jay, thanks for the call. I don't know if you have numbers in front of you, Michael, but what do you think?
Not right in front of me, but it's a good question to ask because the previous caller referred to India and China being the dominant producers, and that may be true in the overall level, but on a per capita basis, the United States remains at the top. It basically reflects the kind of consumer culture and affluence that we have, so we generate more greenhouse gases from the economic activity. Other countries are larger, but so on a per capita basis, they rank a little below the United States, even if on the whole they produce more. But what Jay is saying reminds us that this is a solution to climate change. There'll be a multifaceted solution that's going to take a long time. It's going to be over decades that we find ways to slow the release of greenhouse gases, change our energy dependence to non-fossil fuel sources. And that, by the way, might include nuclear power, and I hope much more research into alternatives to fossil fuels. But it also involves a change in the way we live our lives to reduce this kind of per capita impact that puts us ahead of China and India. And such simple things as turning down the thermostat a bit in winter so you burn less natural gas or whatever other source is being used. And using vehicles that are more fuel efficient. And this is true for industries and for city governments and state governments as well. This needs to be a really big part of the conversation that we have, and we need to get busy. And I think this is the essence of this new report. We cannot delay any longer. The risks are too great. The economic impact on farmers, on the city governments is too great to ignore, and it's about time we got moving on this.
Briefly, Michael, one of our earlier callers used the phrase political will. Do we have even the potential to have the political will to take the kind of actions you're talking about?
Well, I think we do. I mean, you have groups such as one caller referred to, the Citizens Climate Lobby, that's been on a bipartisan basis, has been trying to work with elected officials in Washington and in state capitals to see if we can't come to some agreement on what needs to be done with our carbon revenue-neutral carbon tax. There are many other groups urging a transition to renewable energy and away from fossil fuels. The political challenge is we currently have a national government, and at least the presidential branch, that is not convinced this is a problem or that it's not our problem uniquely and is backtracking on the commitments we made over the past decade. So that really needs to change, and that means the public needs to make clear to political leaders that they really want this change. The polls show that to be the case, but this is typically not a very high salience issue for most people. People communicate their views to elected officials, demand that we take action and do it soon. We'll be on a better track than we are now.
We'll leave it there for now. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us.
Sure, happy to do so.
That's Michael Kraft, Professor Emeritus of Political Science and Public and Environmental Affairs at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. He joined us today to talk about the big climate change report released by the federal government that shows the U.S. will face significant health and economic issues in the present and the near future if climate change isn't addressed. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll round up some of the biggest news in national politics, including a Mississippi Senate race, a new wrinkle for Paul Manafort and the Russia probe, and other big news from the nation's capital and beyond. Wisconsin Congressman Sean Duffy joins the show for a look at his legislation that would end endangered species protections for gray wolves here in the Midwest. And the end of the year is a good time to review our finances and to make sure we don't break the bank buying gifts. A personal finance writer gives advice, and you can share some of yours as well. All that, plus a look at the top news stories of the day. It's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show. Tomorrow at 7, The Stuff We Buy tells a story about political polarization in America. John Munson talks to the author of the new book, Prius or Pickup, How the Answers to Four Simple Questions Explain America's Great Divide. That's tomorrow after 7 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll take a look at a new plan aimed at solving homelessness here in Wisconsin and why our guest says he'd like to see it do even more. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around, there's more to come. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.